The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
We're not trying to explain why the U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency. That's not the point that we want to make, and we use Riston to make, is that underneath the system is a structure of private actors and how they interact with each other. And that's really what Citibank did with its certificate of deposit, is it organized this system of correspondent banks, which then create this leverage, this hook for the U.S. government to get its teeth into these private actors when they want to, enforce sanctions or use its authority in different ways.
I'm Haman Hahn, Associate Editor at Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 20th, 2023. Economic warfare isn't a new concept. Protectionist policies, asymmetrical trade agreements, currency wars, those are just a few examples of the economic levers states have long used to control outcomes. But in their new book, two political scientists, Henry Farrell and Abe Newman, argue that a technological innovation spurred on by free market embracers and co-opted by the US was an accidental entry point into a new era of economic statecraft, an era whose precise contours and rules are still being ironed out today, as we are fighting in a so-called economic war. I talked to them about how this weaponization came to be, how U.S. national security objectives are bleeding into economic warfare, and what policymakers might focus on in trying to ensure that the economic web that the U.S. currently sits at the center of is not ravaged by its own power. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 20th. A Weaponized World Economy, with Henry Farrell and Abe Newman. Thanks, Henry and Abe, for being with us today to talk about your new book, Underground Empire, How America Weaponized the World Economy. Can you tell us what it's about, just to get us started?
Sure. Basically, this book is about all of the arcane and often overseen parts of the plumbing that makes up the international economy, and how those networks that we just take for granted have slowly been turned into a tool of coercion that states are using to kind of battle the wars that they have with each other. So it's really taking what we think of globalization and turning it on its head. Instead of this thing for just peace and prosperity, it's turned as a part of how states conduct coercion and conflict.
Abe, are you saying that globalization is a lie? The Lexus and the olive tree is gone now.
Well, I think we want to say that, there was a naive view that, of course, Thomas Friedman, he had that world is flat. The world is a web, not a wall, not the separation between great powers. And we want to say, look, that at the center of every web is a predator. It's a spider. And they use that web not just to disperse power, but to concentrate power. And so we do want to say, look, the way globalization is constructed is not to decentralize things. It often centralizes. So if you think about Apple or TSMC or JP Morgan, there are these companies, they're not trying to, disperse power. They're trying to concentrate the rents that they can get. And now states have woken up to that, particularly the United States. And they're using that structure, the way the networks are organized, to fight their battles.
Yeah, Very fair. Thanks for taking me on that. So I'd love to start by talking about what the preconditions for empire are. Obviously, you start your analysis with the story of Walter Wriston. Can you tell us a little bit more about what he did in the late 1900s and what you think was needed for the world economy to be able to be weaponized in the way that you argue it was?
So discovering Walter Wriston was, I think, one of the moments where the book really began to come together for us, because you can think of him, if you wanted to be a pejorative, as a proto-Thomas Friedman. But I think he was much more than Friedman, which is not to say that Friedman is nothing. But Friedman is somebody who, in the end of the day, is a commentator. And Wriston was somebody who commentated and who thought, and who clearly came from a strongly libertarian, anti-government perspective. He was one of the members of the Mont Pelerin Society, which is, of course, a famous society where Hayek and other people looked to try and push back the power of government. Wriston was not only an intellectual, though, but he was a doer. He was the CEO of Citibank. And if you look at many, many different aspects of globalization, he was there. And I think in particular, if you look at the financial aspects of globalization, he was somebody who, as the CEO of Citibank in the 1960s and even before the 1960s, he was somebody who was pushing very, very strongly to try to create a global marketplace, which he hoped would be genuinely free of the power of states. He believed that the more that we created these international networks, which would allow finance to flow freely, which would allow trade to flow freely, and then information to flow freely. He was somebody who was very interested in the information economy as well. He believed that this would be a world in which states would be fundamentally disempowered. And he did everything to try and push that. But also, and I think this is the tragedy of Walter Wriston, he was also, of course, a businessman. And in order to try and push forward the interests of Citibank, he wanted to have Citibank at the center of the web. And all other businesses want the same thing, more or less. Inside every lean, hungry entrepreneur, there is a bloated monopolist struggling to get out. And the best way for that bloated monopolist to establish itself is to find a central position, to find a central node in the economy, which it can occupy and where it can make itself so essential that it is able to charge monopoly profits. And in so doing, and this is really the tragedy, I think, of entrepreneurs like Walter Wriston, they set themselves up as targets for state coercion.
Right. So Walter Wriston, again, who was a banker and former chairman and CEO of Citicorp, what did he do exactly to create or put Citigroup in the position of the center of this web?
So what he did was, I think, twofold. One thing which succeeded and one thing which failed. One was that he was one of the bankers who was trying to figure out how to connect the desperate demand for dollars that there was outside of the United States with the supply of dollars in the United States, because this was a time of very, very heavy regulation where it was difficult for businesses to get interest on their deposits, for businesses to make money. And so what he did was he and his people invented this thing called the certificate of deposit, which was one of the key pieces of financial engineering that allowed for the so-called Eurodollar market to come into being. And once Eurodollars started getting going, this is effectively this supply of dollars which is outside of the United States. Once Eurodollars began to get going, you began to see a massive explosion in trade. And of course, you saw various businesses begin to use the dollar as an easy currency of exchange. First of all, if you want, for example, to convert yen into British pounds, there may not have been a particularly liquid market for the conversion. So what you do is you convert yen into dollars and then the dollars into British pounds. And so you have a kind of quick transaction, which allows for you to get paid if you are a supplier who's trying to move goods from the one to the other country. And then sometimes it just makes better sense. And this is something we see increasingly becoming the case. It makes better sense to try and just have both ends of the transaction conducted in dollars. This is easier. This is faster. And so this is one of the reasons that the dollar ascends to international dominance, is because it is such an easy currency of exchange. It is such a big pool. And the fact that euro dollars are there make this possible. But, and this is something that Wriston acknowledges directly, but he doesn't really think through the politics of what this means, when you're constructing this massive euro dollar market, all of these dollars, these are effectively imaginary dollars, which have to be connected to real deposits in real US banks. And that then means that the fact that they have to go through U.S. banks, the fact that they have to go through the so-called dollar clearing system, then means that U.S. authorities have a hook into these transactions if they ever wanted to use it. And the second thing which Wriston does, which he fails in, is he wants to have Citicore, Citibank, he wants to have it at the nexus of a global financial messaging network. He wants to impose Citibank standards on the rest of the world. And this does not succeed. Other banks run away in horror because they recognize that this would be ceding enormous power to one of their competitors. And the failure of this effort pushes other banks to start converging on the SWIFT network, which, as all of us have discovered in the last few years, is in fact the network that it prevails. But then it too turns out to have important geopolitical consequences.
When you say that Wriston was responsible for making or allowing the dollar to really gain the supremacy that it has today, do you think that that story starts with Wriston or maybe earlier with, say, like the Bretton Woods system? Do you think this is a vengeance of the Bretton Woods system that apparently had failed?
So there's a lot of stuff happening there. And of course, you can begin, like every story, you can begin in different places depending on what you want to emphasize. And so what we really wanted to get at in our story is a part of the story which hasn't been told, which is really the way in which the centralization of the world economy, the centralization of power in these banks, in the dollar clearing system, and the power that this gives to US regulators has all of these knock-on consequences, which people didn't, in fact, anticipate. But one of the things that we discovered when we were writing this book is that somebody who is really one of the experts on the Bretton Woods system, this is Eric Heliner. He is a Canadian economist, political economist, he writes back in the 1980s, early 1990s, when Wriston's arguments are in effect at their peak. And he says, well, hold on a moment. If we look at the way in which these financial markets work, everything is concentrating in places like New York and London. And this then gives a possibility for regulators to step in and to grab control of the process. So I would think of this in some ways as being the world we live in is, in a certain sense, Heliner's revenge rather than Wriston's revenge. These insights that he came up with 20, 25 years ago, which were roundly ignored at the time, turn out to be the essential insights that tell us about the world economy that we are in today. And I sometimes wonder what would have happened if people had actually paid attention to what Heliner was saying back then. Would we be living in a very different world now to the world that we are living in fact?
And maybe just to follow up on what Henry said, you know, we're not trying to explain why the US dollar is the global reserve currency. That's not the point that we want to make, and we use Wriston to make, is that underneath the system is a structure of private actors and how they interact with each other. And that's really what Citibank did with a certificate of deposit, is it organized this system of correspondent banks, which then create this leverage, this hook for the US government to get its teeth into these private actors when they want to, enforce sanctions or use its authority in different ways. And so the Wriston's story is kind of, he thought he was creating this network of banks beyond government, but by centralizing it into these few key players, it creates this kind of perverse opportunity.
Definitely. So I think that leads perfectly into the SWIFT battle and why maybe Wriston lost it. Can you tell us a little bit more about that particular technology and how that plays into the plumbing of this empire?
Sure. I mean, I think the SWIFT, one of Wriston's, I think, his discoveries or insights was that finance is at heart an information industry. And so he thought, okay, in order to make kind of the advances, to make real money, you needed to control the information behind what was happening, in the dollars and cents. And so he had this idea of creating, it's basically like a secure post office for banks, it's like going back and forth, telling which bank makes what transfers to which other bank. And that way you could have a more efficient system of clearing these transactions. And, you have to go back. We have these funny stories in the book of like how arcane and just, like, almost like a Sherlock Holmes Victorian novel they used to use to make these transactions happen. People sitting on the phone to keep lines open. You know, it was not the picture of efficiency that most economists would suggest the financial markets are. And so he had this idea, okay, we can make this a lot more efficient if we have this secure messaging system. But of course, if you sit on all the messages, if you're the post office for the global financial system, you're going to be able to read a lot of mail. And other banks basically panicked and said, okay, we cannot let Citi be the only purveyor of the system. And so that's when a group of European and also competitors, American competitors of Citi, they came together and they had this idea of let's create a cooperative where it's joint, you know, ownership. And that that organization, which is based in Belgium, that they would be this the kind of the heartbeat of the information system of finance. And for many years, nobody knew anything about it. You know, it was like it was this arcane, really obscure corporation or, you know, non-governmental corporation. And it was only then during 9/11 that it really takes on a new role after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, the U.S. government is panicked and looking around, trying to figure out, you know, how do we deal with this new threat? And they see SWIFT and they discover that Wriston's insight about sitting on the heartbeat of the information system could be powerful for them as well.
Yeah. So can you tell us more about how the U.S. government in the 9/11 moment had the authority to access or tried to force its way into the SWIFT network?
Well, at the beginning, you know, it was an interesting part about the SWIFT system was that it had a mirroring facility. So it kept its data in Belgium, but it also mirrored that data in the United States, in Virginia. And so the U.S. government could just subpoena the organization because it had a physical presence in the United States. And that's how things start. And it's really, it's a secret program that, you know, is not really announced publicly until 2006, when there's a New York Times expose that reveals that this has been happening. And that's, you know, that's actually another career story that Henry, this is how we got into this whole, this article was we were writing a different book about US and European fights over privacy. And a big part of that fight is this fight about SWIFT and the data. And that's when we were thinking like, oh my God, this isn't just a story about privacy. This is a story about how the global economy has been transformed and this interaction between private networks and state power.
So the way that the US would subpoena, for instance, is this going through, for instance, 702? You know, you tell one story in which there's a Reuters reporter who then kind of triggers a DOJ investigation. So when we're thinking about the weapon, as it were, how is it actually effectively triggered in the day-to-day? I know that it's a very shrouded kind of enterprise, but for folks who are trying to understand exactly how you would use the weapon, what kind of triggers and entry points are used regularly?
So we don't have any direct information on that. As far as I know, the subpoenas have never actually been revealed. So what we know is primarily thanks to the reporting of people like Eric Lichtblau and James Risen. They may have seen the particulars, but of course, since they're reporters and since they are writing primarily for a public audience rather than a legal audience, they have not revealed this. And also, I should be clear that Abe and myself, we are not lawyers ourselves. So in a sense, what we're doing is we're trying to piece this together as political scientists. And so the debates that we are engaged in are really debates around power and the ways in which power is used and the particular legal authorities that are patched together. We are relying to some greater or lesser degree on legal commentary to find our way through the maze because we are not ourselves the people who are going to be able to give you very, very helpful specifics on, well, this authority was used, maybe that authority could have been used instead. Perhaps this authority has been overused. That's a story that we would love to see told by people who were actual legal scholars. And bits and pieces of that story have been told, but nobody, I think, has tried to do it in exactly the same way as we have. Perhaps the closest is a book by Pierre-Hugues Verdier, which looks at, it's called Global Banks on Trial, and it provides a law professor's understanding of how it is that the financial system has been used to subordinate U.S. banks.
I would just add the one thing that we did, I mean, I think we would agree on, is just the way that the legal authority is really cobbled together and a patchwork. There's no, you know, this was not like some plot to create a legal structure that would then dominate the world. You know, it's like regulators are basically looking around at wicked problems that they're facing in the moment and then thinking about, you know, what kind of legal tools do they have at their disposal? And so you mentioned 702, which is, you know, something that is created after 9/11, but also there are things that go back, you know, decades of 50, you know, 60 years, IEPA or the export control system. You know, these were not invented as modern tools of coercion, but really out of a whole different cloth, different circumstances, whether it was, you know, World War II issues or post, you know, the Cold War. And one of the things that we try to say in the book is that, you know, a lot of these things are not purpose-built. And so that creates a lot of tensions and problems when they're being used. I was just having a conversation with a lawyer the other day where, you know, he was bemoaning how hard it is to revoke sanctions once they've been imposed on an individual because of the way they were constructed. They weren't really thought of as, you know, this kind of economic warfare. They were part of a much bigger idea that there was a national security threat and that, you know, this probably wasn't going to go away very quickly. Where if you look at the way the legal institutions are built in the European Union, for example, it's much more of a set of, you know, penalties that are seen as based in economic reasoning and economic logic. So we definitely think that the legal authorities matter and that they are warping and shaping this process. But as Henry said, we are not, we only play caveman lawyers in our book.
Yeah. And just the one thing which I think both the people who are critical of these measures and the people who are in favor of these measures, I think everybody agrees that the law is a mess, that all of this thing, all of this has been patched together, as Abe says, from a variety of different authorities, from a variety of different instruments, some of which have been warped and strained in order to provide the necessary powers, some of which have been reinterpreted, some of which were more or less designed for purpose, but not necessarily designed to fit into a broader architecture. So this is something that from the outside, I think looks to the people who are targeted by it, it looks like some vast monolithic leviathan, some kind of Moloch or behemoth, which is crushing and squashing them and which is a single powerful, terrifying thing. If you look at it from the inside, it's a relatively small number of extremely overworked people desperately rushing from crisis to crisis with a, oh my God, we've got to deal with X. What do we have to hand that can help us deal with X and trying to figure it out on the fly? So I think that this is one of the arguments of our story is this is not, as Abe says, it is not a conspiracy. This is not a grand master plan. Instead, it is to a very great degree, it is a kind of a accidental construction, or at least a construction where people are, they're putting together the individual pieces of it, and they don't necessarily have the opportunity or the wherewithal to think about how this actually fits together, how this creates in some broader sense a system.
Yes, well, we love the dispelling of the deep state myths on this podcast. But I do want to push back ever so slightly to ask, you know, you're saying that these authorities have existed for a while and no one really thought to maybe put them together in this particular way before. But it kind of does go back to maybe an idea that we might be just swinging backwards in this pendulum of protectionism versus free market trade liberalism kind of back and forth. So does the fact that these authorities can be used in this way kind of suggest that there was or is and has been a kind of intention to use economic statecraft for kind of competitive advantage purposes that can be traced farther back than maybe this kind of haphazard putting together of things?
Very short answer to that, which is look for our next piece in Foreign Affairs, which exactly discusses that. It is exactly on the ways in which we are, in a certain sense, we're seeing something that looks on the surface like a reversion to some of the practices of the Cold War, but in a fundamentally different, world, a world which is massively interdependent in ways that the economic world of the Cold War was not. So I don't want to say that much more about this. Our editors at Foreign Affairs will be very, very grumpy. what I will say is that I think that some of these instruments could be used for purposes of economic competition. But as we describe in the book, if you talk to officials such as Kevin Wolf, who was the person who really ran the export control system under the Obama administration, it is absolutely clear that he did not think of his job as being a job of pushing forward American economic interests. What he saw his job as being was fundamentally and profoundly trying to protect the national security of the United States by identifying potential threats such as Huawei and using whatever powers he and other officials could leverage in order to ensure that the national security interests of the United States were protected.
And I would just say, you know, like these conversations, they go back to Alexander Hamilton. You know, like this isn't new sauce for the United States thinking about, you know, that economic interdependence can create national security concerns. I think what we think is different and what is unique in the way that these tools are being applied right now is the global or extraterritorial way in which they're being used. So, you know, the U.S. has done economic statecraft forever. It's very common for it to put, say, we're going to close our market access to you if you don't do what we like. And that was kind of the standard story for much of the post-war period was, you know, basically traditional sanctions. But what we're kind of talking about here is where the U.S. is conditioning access to these global networks, these choke points. And so it's not just about the U.S. market. It's about you won't have access to the dollar clearing system, or you will not have access to U.S. intellectual property when you're making products, you know, yourself in your foreign country to export to another third party. And that's really, I think, unique, as well as the surveillance aspect, you know, that it's these global networks provide a window into the world in a way that, you know, we didn't have. Even the NSA satellite systems did not have the same kind of, because of just the massive use of Google, you know, that transforms the capabilities that a state could have.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got
my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
I want to go back just quickly to the delineation between national security and economic advantage. So Treasury Secretary Yellen said back in April, "Let me be clear, these national security actions are not designed for us to gain a competitive economic advantage or stifle China's economic and technological modernization. Even though these policies may have economic impacts, they are driven by straightforward national security considerations. We will not compromise on these concerns, even when they force trade-offs with our economic interests." So I want your reaction to what she said here in two ways. First, do you think that there can be quite a clear delineation between national security interests and economic interests? Or what do you think about trying to separate those two ideas? And second, I think one of the things that you say in this book is that it is not strategic to over leverage these kinds of economic tools, because of course, the way that you gain power in this kind of web is to be the web and to be the access points and to bring people to your markets and want it and to have your currency be at the heart of it all. So how do you strategically balance those two different objectives? And what do you think is the moment that you say, actually, this is turning into the wrong use of or an overextension of the economic weapon?
These are two great questions, and they do go together to some important degree. So when we think about economic versus security, my sense is that Biden administration officials are completely sincere when they say this. They are completely sincere in their desire to do this. And also, given that many of the authorities that they're using are effectively national security authorities, because there is not a particularly well-developed economic security apparatus in the US, to some extent, they have to do this. Equally, it's very, very clear that you see a lot of pressure from businesses who see this as being a possible source of advantage for them. There is no doubt that businesses are lobbying the US government to say, well, have you looked at this threat? Have you looked at that threat? And whatever. And so that possibly could have some consequences. But of course, we can't see what those consequences are very clearly right now. You can see, for example, I think one very good example of this, which we discuss in our book, is the way that when Intel finds itself making a set of poor technological decisions so that it is behind TSMC on the race to get to 7-nanometer type semiconductors, it finds itself in a disadvantaged position. So Gelsinger, the CEO of Intel, begins to talk up the ways in which TSMC is located in a geostrategic danger zone and suggests that there should be incentives for U.S. companies, that are not going to be nearly as dangerous, nearly as worrying in some ways as TSMC. He later moderates his language on this, but I think that gives you some understanding perhaps of the ways in which business, of course, is going to look at this landscape as being a strategic landscape that it can press its own interests on. I think that the bigger and more profound question is the one that you point to, which is the question in a sense that I think is one of the motivating questions of our book, which is, here's how we would put it, can the US credibly commit to use its powers only up to a certain point and not beyond that point? And I think that this is something which is has been actually a source of US strength in the past, is the fact that the United States, for all of its messiness, for all of the problems with its system, it actually has the rule of law. And this means that there are certain things that the US can commit, at least in principle, not to do. But the more that the United States is tempted to push that envelope, the more that the United States is going to be incapable of taking advantage of that. And one of the side effects of the way in which the system has grown is that if you're trying desperately to battle off these immediate threats, which keep on coming at you and multiplying, you don't necessarily think about the long-term consequences for the US's reputation, for the US's ability to say, actually, we're not going to do this. And this is reflected, for example, in what Abe said about the incapacity to roll back sanctions once they have been imposed. There are many, many other ways in which the United States fundamentally finds itself incapable of restraining itself. That's going to become, I think, a very important issue over the next couple of months as we decide what to do about the revelations that Huawei and SMIC have apparently managed to figure out ways to produce semiconductors that the US thought that they would probably be incapable of producing. And it faces the US with a somewhat difficult choice. Does it go ahead with a much more comprehensive set of measures designed to prevent Chinese companies from acquiring these technologies, in which case it will sort of be achieving its security interests, but it's also going to certainly raise up the fears in China and in other countries that the United States is effectively going to be out of control? Or alternatively, does it let this ride, in which case it potentially provides a technological advantage to a rival and to an adversary who can obviously do terrible things in Taiwan if and when it believes that it has the capacity to do so? So I don't think Abe and I, we are not in the hot seat, thank God. We are not making those kinds of decisions. But it does give you some sense of the trade-offs and the ways in which these trade-offs are affected by the U.S. incapacity to credibly commit itself to structures which would really reinforce Yellen's message here. And that, I think, is an important aspect of U.S. strategy, which has to be considered when the U.S. begins to start thinking seriously about what its doctrine of economic statecraft ought to be.
And if I could just raise like a third concern, which is, you know, everybody, I think, quickly goes to the Trump steel tariffs, national security. You know, this is just brutal protectionism. There was this funny, you know, Canadian that they had their cars and the Transformer Bumblebee was going to, you know, ravage the United States or whatever. So I think that can happen. You can have the kind of the seepage from the national security, the economic. But in addition to the point that Henry was just making about that we could overuse this, the other thing is we don't even understand how these tools, when they're used, what the response can be on the other side. And I think the Huawei example is really important because here's a case where we don't have a competitor. You know, we sold off all of our competitors. This isn't some hidden you know, thing where we're trying to promote Nokia, you know, it's like that really, that's the story. You know, it's a story where we're worried that they would create a surveillance tool that would, you know, basically function over the globe. And we're out there trying to, you know, destroy it, basically, the United States government. And for me, what's so important to think about is that how provocative that action is. Imagine a Chinese government set of policies went and said, we're going to destroy the New York Stock Exchange because it's a really powerful global tool for the United States. You know, when you target another country's hub, they're kind of a global firm. Yes, it is. I think Yellen is being completely honest of what she's saying, but that doesn't mean that it's still not provocative vis-a-vis China. So there, I don't think it's not a threat about our networks being attractive. I think people will still be using U.S. banks. I think the U.S. still has many firms, you know, that are very attractive. But in the dynamic that it creates with another great power, there's no real strategic doctrine. How should we think about this? When should we restrain ourselves? When should we use it? And I think that was a case of we're seeing it play out in real time of, you know, people acting in a crisis and trying to solve a problem and then moving down a path that could spiral.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing up the case study of Huawei. And just that to me suggests that a part of economic statecraft and part of your story as well is the kind of agreements between the US and the EU on data transfers and surveillance generally. Do you have thoughts on the kind of coordination between economic actors generally and the privacy folks moving forward in terms of how the kind of economic doctrine needs to align with different aspects of like US security measures?
So this talks to our previous book of Privacy and Power, which, as Abe said, is the inadvertent parent of the project that we're now engaged in, because we started looking at these questions. And as Abe said, we just saw that there were all of these networks which seemed really boring and functional and people weren't paying attention to them, but were in fact becoming the locus of power struggles. And the rest for us and for our careers as public commentators is history. What I would say, I think, is that the dilemma that the United States faces here is that it is really hard for the US to give the kinds of strong guarantees that would really solve the problems that it faces with Europe. So we have seen another agreement being struck. I think that there are not a huge number of people who are particularly confident that that agreement is going to stand the test of time. Max Schrems is gunning for it, and there's going to be another ECJ decision. And if I were a betting man, I would not be laying long odds on the ECJ deciding that, yes, this agreement, which differs in detail, but not in profound and fundamental structure from previous agreements, I don't think that the ECJ is going to be particularly happy with it. So I think that what we could see, but this would require a very different US approach and also would be very difficult, I think, given profound European nervousness about the election of Donald Trump in 2016 and all of the things that we are familiar with as a result of that. I think that you would have to see a much deeper form of legal integration between the EU and US, in which Europeans fundamentally had some degree of genuine privacy rights under US law. And obviously, there would have to be some reciprocity involved in that arrangement. This is something which I think would be a very, very difficult pill for the intelligence community to swallow. We saw, I think, in, we describe it in the book, how it is that when you see the former head of the NSA, Michael Hayden, somebody raises it. It's Orrin Hatch, as I recall. Somebody raises the prospect of, why do we give privacy rights for foreigners? And Hayden describes his contempt for this ridiculous suggestion. More or less, the Fourth Amendment does not apply to non-US citizens. So to hell with their privacy rights. As far as Hayden is concerned, it is game on if US interests are at stake. I think that is a perfectly comprehensible motivation. If you are somebody in the intelligence community, if you have been trained, if you have grown up with that particular set of values, but it is not a set of motivations which are going to be compatible with the kind of deal that might really allow the EU and the US to cooperate together in a deeper sense on these issues, and instead of the current arrangement, which obviously there's a lot of informal alignment that happens between the US and different national intelligence agencies in Europe, but this is perpetually under legal threat and under political threat as well, because nobody likes to see their privacy being invaded by foreign countries.
You know, I agree completely with Henry. The only thing I wonder about is that, you know, the Hayden quote was, you know, he was very focused on 9/11 and this threat of terrorism. And I think right now the national security focus has shifted towards Asia and to China in particular. And so you could imagine a rethink where people say, you know, how do we create a system that promotes confidence that you're not just basically that there's a rule of law in global information systems. And you could imagine the US government saying, we are going to basically legalize pledges that were made under presidential kind of directives, turn them into law, and say, you know, amongst, I don't know, NATO partners, or, you know, you could create a group of people where you guarantee these kind of rule of law for information in a way to stand up as an alternative to China, where the system is just, it does have more surveillance threats. I think there's often this like, well, the US is just like China. It's like, no, it's not just like China. We still have all these legal processes that are in place to make sure that there's not just rampant abuse of how information is used. But I think the more that we could create constraints on our ability to do that and to show that to the world, then the better off we would be and the more persuasive it would be in this kind of competition between systems. And so my plea would be, hey, that perspective was more about global terrorism, but really we have a different one now. And we can imagine a world where creating a Western set of privacy guarantees would help us in our national security.
Right. And I mean, this speaks to the kind of meta conversation of whose world are we building? And, you know, China would argue that it's, again, kind of a rigged world. How do you see the international organizations or international regulations working into this? Do you think that there is a role to be played by a larger overseeing mechanism that might be kind of intrastate, or is it really incumbent and is the impetus on the US to kind of self-enforce and create these rules and show the international community that it will be interacting in this way?
So, I mean, I think fundamentally these powers that we're talking about are unilateral powers. You know, it's whether the US or China or the European Union uses them, they are using kind of domestic legal authority to have transnational or global consequences. I don't think there's going to be a P5 consent to using economic coercion. That, you know, I think that would is unworkable. But I do think that there is a role for international organizations, and we're already seeing that. So the most clear development was the G7 in their meeting in Japan in the spring. They set out kind of a cooperative economic coercion response framework. And the idea was if members of the G7 are threatened, that they would coordinate together to respond to that. And it was clearly a Japanese initiative that was trying to push back against potential Chinese economic coercion. But I think on a broader level, what I think is the most important is to have a set of kind of legal conversations at the international law level. So this could be in working groups at the UN, not about P5, but just, you know, in like a committee on economic coercion where people come up with the ideas of what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. There's no way you're going to be able to, you know, constrain the United States, China, or the European Union perfectly, but you can create a more accountable, transparent, and political conversation that creates, discipline on actors that overstep. And right now, I think that in many of the actors, they don't even know, they haven't fully thought through what the parameters should be. So I think having those kinds of legal dialogues at the international level and in international organizations can help flesh that out. And it would help the national actors as they're using these tools to think through, okay, what is responsible use and where should we draw the line?
Just to emphasize the last thing that Abe has said, I think is super duper important, which is that it really is when you're confronted with these questions, when you're talking to outsiders, to people in different systems, that you really do begin to think about your own system in a different way and what your interests are and what kinds of things you should or should not do. And that conversation, it may be happening in very off the record ways right now, but certainly there isn't much in the way of public evidence of that conversation having consequences if it does exist.
So I want to end by, and I know that this is not something that you had time to address in this book, but perhaps the victims of the economic warfare. So obviously your story is about the major wielders of this weapon, but I'm curious what your sense of the downstream effects of, for instance, economic coercion or statecraft is. For instance, for sanctions, you can kind of trace, you know, this is one person who's designated, you can't have interaction with that person. But of course, the bigger downstream effects are countries lacking access to food, materials, and you can obviously explain, you know, that those are consequences that are needed when the heads of those states make bad decisions, especially, you know, terrorist countries. But I'm curious what your sense of the effects of this weaponization are and the kind of victims of this warcraft is.
Well, this is something we thought about when we were writing the book, and we've got a little bit in the final acknowledgement section where we say more or less pretty explicitly, this is a book which is written from the perspective of those that have power. There's another book that could be written, which is equally and plausibly more important, which is written from the perspective of those who have these effects imposed upon them, but are not able to mobilize to defend their interests in the ways that the big powers that we focus on, the United States, China, and the European Union, are able to. So I think you could look at this from a variety of different perspectives. First, you could think about this just from the point of view of the consequences of economic weapons for countries which have been severely hit by them. There is a lot of work being done by my Johns Hopkins colleagues on what is happening in Iran, which I would recommend to listeners to see. This is important. And also sometimes the perverse consequences that sanctions can have. So that one of the consequences, if you are targeting the legitimate economy, is that you may empower actors such as in Iran, the Revolutionary Guard, to take more and more control of what is actually there. And this is something which I think, you know, certainly there are technical discussions around it, but the extent to which this actually reaches discussions about grand strategy, I'm very, very unsure that people really are systematically integrating these possible effects in. Secondly, you could think about this from the perspective of middle powers, another country which we hardly talk about at all, but which is, of course, important, is India. We do mention how Indonesia was spooked by some of the efforts of the Biden administration of the European Union in coordination to impose a price cap on oil being exported from Russia. The Indonesian foreign minister suggested that this was something which would be seen by countries such as Indonesia as perhaps the prelude to efforts by advanced countries to try and impose these kinds of restrictions on exporting countries which exported basic materials in general, what kinds of worries that might lead to. And you can look, you know, there are many, many different aspects that you could look at this from. We don't talk about this because this is a short book. We can own, and we're also talking to the areas where we have particular expertise. But this is a hugely important set of questions, in a sense, the shadow that empire casts, which is something that we don't really talk about, but which we think is fundamentally important.
And I would just add, you know, on the one hand, some of these tools are much more targeted than, you know, traditional sanctions. And that is, you know, people have often held that up as a benefit. You know, it's like we're targeting the semiconductor supply chain for advanced AI chips. You know, it's not a, you know, a universal embargo on China. And so in that way, you know, the hope is that these would produce less pain for your average citizen. At the same time, one of the things that we keep seeing and we stress in the book are just the global economy is so complex and our governmental understanding of it is pretty thin. And the chance that you could have unanticipated consequences is very high. And so we tell the story of, you know, after the 2016 election, the Trump administration goes after an oligarch, Oleg Deripaska. He has an aluminum empire in Russia. And so they sanction this oligarch. And then all of a sudden they get panic calls from Limerick, Ireland. And you're like, well, what's going on in Limerick? Well, they have a huge alumina factory there that is a subsidiary of Deripaska's empire. And so, you know, these kinds of interconnectedness, you know, the basically that factory in Limerick, it supplies most of Western Europe's kind of very specialized aluminum, and it was going to shut down the car, you know, sector in many countries. So that kind of unexpected outcome is one of the dangers of using these tools where people's real lives can then be affected in a way that you wouldn't have anticipated. Similarly, I mean, the gas pipeline wars in Europe, I was in Berlin last year, and there were many months where there was a real worry that we wouldn't have gas, you know, heating. And so, you know, we have to realize that people's lives are being affected by this, what we think of as very high politics warfare. And I think there's the clearest example, which people don't want to talk about, but is the reverberation of the Snowden revelations. You know, it's like we try to forget that was all made public. But if you go to many other countries, you know, it's a very important moment where people realize that this global internet that we created, it's not just about freedom and access and possibility, but it's also about power, and that has real consequences and has had effects that we really need to understand if we're going to use these tools effectively.
So to extend your analogy of this being the economic equivalent of a nuclear arsenal, I'm hearing that there are many potential little red buttons that could be pushed and we might not be aware of it. Is that accurate?
So one of the best quotes we got from somebody was a former lawyer for Deripaska's company, Rusal, who referred pejoratively to the U.S. approach to economic warfare as the what does this button do approach. And I think that's probably somewhat unfair. There is a lot of data, a lot of care, which goes into, for example, the decisions of Treasury, who to target, what to do, and so on. But you've got to remember, again, that this is a spectacularly under-resourced branch of the U.S. government. When you compare the vast amounts of money that go into the Department of Defense to the pitiful trickle of funding and resources that goes to these questions of economic security, you really come to the conclusion that there's something fundamentally wrong with the U.S. sense of priorities, especially as these issues have come to the fore. So I think one of the things that we would really press for, and again, this is something where I think there would plausibly be agreement between a lot of people, is if the U.S. is going to do this stuff, it wants to do it right. And that is going to involve a lot of transformation of government structures to make sure that this is not just a small number of harried, overworked people running around from crisis to crisis, but that there is an actual understanding of the world that allows these people to do what they are supposed to do, and ideally does not have too much in the way of unexpected repercussions. And when there are unexpected repercussions, that there are the appropriate means of flexibility, that the U.S. is able to change course in a reasonably timely fashion.
And is there any sort of red flag for either of you when it comes to this kind of warfare? It strikes me that this is, you know, ambient, ever going in the background. Sometimes it comes to the fore more readily. What would be a sign for you that we are engaged in a kind of point of no return type of economic warfare?
I don't know. but I don't think anybody else knows either. And that is part of the problem, that if you think about the world economy, the world economy is an incredibly complex system. For a long time, we pretended that this complexity could be handled by market mechanisms. This was the fundamental approach during the era of globalization, which was that the ideas of people like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman were awesome, that markets could be trusted to look after themselves, either because you believed that markets were capable of thinking about the future better, or because you believed in the fundamentals notions of economic efficiency or whatever. And now we've discovered that markets have profound national security consequences as well. But these national security consequences are really, really, really difficult to predict in advance. So I think that the best that we can do is to try and sort of increase our economic intelligence so that we have a better understanding of what it is that we're doing. And I think extreme caution when it comes to pressing buttons that look as if they might plausibly be the red buttons that will lead to the equivalent of Holocaust or of major consequences in interactions between great powers.
And just to like put a nail on the head there is that the stakes are very high. You know, it's like we have a global economy that provides so much to the societies of the world. You know, that if you think about the number of people that have been lifted out of poverty in the last 30 years, you know, it's amazing. And that's what's at stake right now. You know, that kind of, if we go past a tipping point where economic security overwhelms market interactions, then you could really see a pulling back that would threaten all of that. And so I think the main point at the end of the book that we're trying to make is to say, we don't want to risk all of that. We need to come up with a set of kind of guiding principles so that we can save the majority of globalization, even while we recognize that there are these vulnerabilities and threats. And so that's kind of, you know, what we're hoping to do is in the foreign affairs piece Henry mentioned, is lay out some of those ideas.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much. We'll leave it there. Thanks again for your time. And I'm looking forward to having folks read.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again. This was a great conversation.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Pacha-Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Jay Venables of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.